jobs you can. Spend nothing. Marry an EU citizen and get your papers. Then your life can begin.
Nicholas seemed to feel that he had done his part, delivered words of wisdom, and in the following months he hardly spoke to Obinze at all. It was as if he was no longer the big cousin who had offered Obinze at 15 a cigarette to try, who had drawn diagrams on a piece of paper to show Obinze what to do when his fingers were between a girl's legs. On weekends, Nicholas walked around the house in a tense cloud of silence, nursing his worries. Only during Arsenal matches did he relax a little, a can of Stella Artois in hand, shouting, "Go, Arsenal!" with Odjugo and their children, Na and Ne. After the game, his face would congeal once again. He would come home from work, hug his children and Odjugo, and ask, "How are you? What did you people do today?" Odjugo would list what they had done. Cello, piano, violin, homework, kumon. "Nne is really improving her sight-reading," she would add, or, "Nna was careless with his kumon and he got two wrong." Nicholas would praise or reprimand each child. Nna, who had a chubby bulldog-like face, and Nne, who had her mother's dark, broad-faced beauty. He spoke to them only in English, careful English, as though he'd thought that the Igbo he shared with their mother would infect them, perhaps make them lose their precious British accents. Then he would say, "Odjugo, well done. I'm hungry." "Yes, Nicholas." She would serve his food, a plate on a tray taken to him in his study or in front of the TV in the kitchen. Obinze sometimes wondered if she bowed while putting it down, or whether the bowing was merely in her demeanour, in the slump of her shoulders and curve of her neck. Nicholas spoke to her in the same tone as he spoke to his children. Once Obinze heard him say to her, "You people have scattered my study. Now please leave my study, all of you."
"Yes, Nicholas," she said, and took the children out. "Yes, Nicholas," was her response to almost everything he said.
Sometimes from behind Nicholas she would catch Obinze's eye and make a funny face, inflating her cheeks into small balloons, or pushing her tongue out of the corner of her mouth. It reminded Obinze of the gaudy theatrics of Nollywood films.
"I keep thinking of how you and Nicholas were in Nsoka," Obinze said one afternoon, as he helped her cut up a chicken.
"Uh-uh. Do you know we used to fuck in public? We did it at the Arts Theatre, even in the engineering building one afternoon in a quiet corner of the corridor."
She laughed.
"Marriage changes things, but this country is not easy. I got my papers because I did postgraduate school here, but you know he only got his papers 2 years ago, and so for so long he was living in fear, working under other people's names. That thing can do wonders to your head, Izioku. It has not been easy at all for him. This job he has now is very good, but he's on contract. He never knows if they will renew. He got a good offer in Ireland. You know, Ireland is seriously booming now, and computer programmers do well there. But he doesn't want us to move there. Education for the kids is much better here."
Obinze selected some spice bottles from the cupboard, sprinkled them on the chicken, and put the pot on the stove.
"You put nutmeg in chicken?"
Odjugo asked.
"Yes," Obinze said.
"Don't you?"
"Me? What do I know? Whoever marries you will win a lottery, honestly. By the way, what did you say happened to you and Ifemelu? I so liked her."
"She went to America, and her eyes opened, and she forgot me."
Odjugo laughed. The phone rang. Because Obinze was all the time willing a call from his job agency, each time the phone did ring, a mild panic would seize his chest, and Odjugo would say,
"Don't worry, the Zed. Things will work out for you. Look at my friend Bose. You know she applied for asylum, was denied, and went through hell before she finally got her papers. Now she owns two nurseries and has a holiday home in Spain. It will happen for you. Don't worry. Rapuba."
There was a certain vapidity to her reassurance, an automatic way of expressing goodwill, which did not require any concrete efforts on her part to help him. Sometimes he wondered, not resentfully, whether she truly wanted him to find a job, because he would no longer be able to watch the children while she popped out to Tesco to buy milk, no longer be able to make their breakfast while she supervised their practice before school, Nne on the piano or violin, and Nna on the cello. There was something about those days that Obinze would come to miss, buttering toast in the weak light of morning, while the sounds of music floated through the house, and sometimes too, or Jugo's voice, raised in praise or impatience, saying, "Well done, try once more," or, "What rubbish are you doing?" Later that afternoon, after Ojugo brought the children home from school, she told Nna,
"Your Uncle Ubinze cooked the chicken."
"Thank you for helping Mummy, Uncle, but I don't think I'll be having any chicken."
He had his mother's playful manner.
"Look at this boy," Ojugo said. "Your uncle is a better cook than I am."
Nna rolled his eyes.
"Okay, Mummy, if you say so. Can I watch TV? Just for 10 minutes.
"Okay. 10 minutes.
It was the half-hour break after their homework and before their French tutor arrived, and Ojugo was making jam sandwiches, carefully cutting off the crusts. Nna turned on the television to a music performance by a man wearing many large, shiny chains around his neck.
"Mummy, I've been thinking about this,"
Nna said.
"I want to be a rapper."
"You can't be a rapper, Nna."
"But I want to, Mummy."
"You are not going to be a rapper, sweetheart. We did not come to London for you to become a rapper."
She turned to Obinze, stifling laughter.
"You see this boy?"
Nne came into the kitchen, a Capri Sun in hand.
"Mummy, may I have one, please?"
"Yes, Nne,"
she said, and turning to Obinze, repeated her daughter's words in an exaggerated British accent.
"Mummy, may I have one, please?
You see how she sounds so posh. Ha! My daughter will go places. That is why all our money is going to Brentwood School."
Ojugo gave Nne a loud kiss on her forehead, and Obinze realized, watching her idly straighten a stray bread on Nne's head, that Ojugo was a wholly contented person. Another kiss on Nne's forehead.
"How are you feeling, Oinea?"
she asked.
"Fine, Mummy."
"Tomorrow, remember not to read only the line they ask you to read. Go further, okay?"
"Okay, Mummy."
Nne had the solemn demeanor of a child determined to please the adults in her life.
"You know, her violin exam is tomorrow, and she struggles with sight reading," Ojugo said, as though Obinze could possibly have forgotten,
as though it were possible to forget when Ojugo had been talking about it for so long. The past weekend, he had gone with Ojugo and the children to a birthday party in an echo-filled rented hall, Indian and Nigerian children running around, while Ojugo whispered to him about some of the children, who was clever at maths but could not spell, who was Nne's biggest rival. She knew the recent test scores of all the clever children. When she could not remember what an Indian child, Nne's close friend, had scored on a recent test, she called Nne to ask her.
"Ah, Ojugo, let her play," Obinze said.
Now, Ojugo planted a third loud kiss on Nne's forehead.
"My precious. We still have to get a dress for the party."
"Yes, Mummy. Something red. No, burgundy."
"Her friend is having a party, this Russian girl. They became friends because they have the same violin tutor. The first time I met the girl's mother, I think she was wearing something illegal, like the fur of an extinct animal, and she was trying to pretend that she did not have a Russian accent, being more British than the British."
"She's nice, Mummy,"
Nne said.
"I didn't say she wasn't nice, my precious," Ojugo said.
Nna had increased the television volume.
"Turn that down, Nna," Ojugo said.
"Mummy!"
"Turn down the volume right now."
"But I can't hear anything, Mummy."
He didn't turn down the volume, and she didn't say anything else to him. Instead, she turned to Obinze to continue talking.
"Speaking of accents," Obinze asked, "would Nna get away with that if he didn't have a foreign accent?"
"What do you mean?"
"You know, last Saturday, when Chika and Bose brought their children, I was just thinking that Nigerians here really forgive so much from their children because they have foreign accents. The rules are different."
"But it's not about accents. It is because in Nigeria, people teach their children fear instead of respect. We don't want them to fear us. But that does not mean we take rubbish from them. We punish them. The boy knows I will slap him if he does any nonsense. Seriously, slap him."
"The lady doth protest too much, methinks."
"Oh, but she'll keep her word," Ojugo smiled. "You know, I haven't read a book in ages. No time."
"My mother used to say you would become a leading literary critic."
"Yes, before her brother's son got me pregnant."
Ojugo paused, still smiling.
Now it's just these children. I want Nna to go to the City of London School, and then by God's grace, to Marlborough or Eton. Nne is already an academic star, and I know she'll get scholarships to all the good schools. Everything is about them now.
One day, they will be grown and leave home, and you will just be a source of embarrassment or exasperation for them, and they won't take your phone calls or won't call you for weeks, Ubinze said, and as soon as he had said it, he wished he had not. It was petty. It had not come out as he intended. But Odjugo was not offended. She shrugged and said,
Then I will just carry my bag and go and stand in front of their house.
It puzzled him that she did not mourn all the things she could have been. Was it a quality inherent in women? Or did they just learn to shield their personal regrets, to suspend their lives, subsume themselves in childcare? She browsed online forums about tutoring and music and schools, and she told him what she had discovered, as though she truly felt the rest of the world should be as interested as she was in how music improved the mathematic skills of 9-year-olds. Or she would spend hours on the phone, talking to her friends about which violin teacher was good and which tutorial was a waste of money. One day after she had rushed off to take Nna to his piano lesson, she called Obinze to say, laughing,
Can you believe I forgot to brush my teeth?
She came home from Weight Watchers meetings to tell him how much she had lost or gained, hiding Twix bars in her handbag, and then asking him with laughter if he wanted one. Later she joined another weight loss program, attended 2 morning meetings, and came home to tell him,
I'm not going there again. They treat you as if you have a mental problem. I said, No, I don't have any internal issues. Please, I just like the taste of food. And the smug woman tells me that I have something internal that I am repressing. Rubbish! These white people think that everybody has their mental problems.
She was twice the size she had been in university, and while her clothes back then had never been polished, they had the edge of a calculated style, jeans folded away from her ankles, slouchy blouses pulled off one shoulder. Now they merely looked sloppy. Her jeans left a mound of pulpy flesh above her waist that disfigured her T-shirts, as though something alien were growing underneath. Sometimes her friends visited, and they would sit in the kitchen talking until they all dashed off to pick up their children. In those weeks of willing the phone to ring, Ubinze came to know their voices well. He could hear clearly from the tiny bedroom upstairs, where he lay in bed reading.
I met this man recently, Chika said. He is nice, oh, but he is so bush. He grew up in Onitsha. And so you can imagine what kind of bush accent he has. He mixes up ch and sh. I want to go to the shopping center. Sit down on a chair.
They laughed.
Anyway, he told me he was willing to marry me and adopt Charles. Willing, as if he was doing charity work. Willing. Imagine that. But it's not his fault. It's because we are in London. He's the kind of man I would never even look at in Nigeria, not to talk of going out with. The problem is that water never finds its different levels here in London.
London is a leveler. We are now all in London, and we are now all the same.
What nonsense, Bose said.
Maybe he should go and find a Jamaican woman, Amara said. Her husband had left her for a Jamaican woman, with whom it turned out he had a secret 4-year-old child, and she somehow managed to veer every conversation towards the subject of Jamaicans. These West Indian women are taking our men, and our men are stupid enough to follow them. Next thing, they will have a baby, and they don't want the men to marry them all. They just want child support. All they do is spend their money doing their hair and nails.
Yes, Bose, Chika, and Odjugo all agreed.
A routine automatic agreement. Amara's emotional well-being was more important than what they actually believed. The phone rang. Odjugo took the call and came back to say,
This woman just called. She is a character. Her daughter and Nne belong to the same orchestra. I met her when Nne took her first exam. She came in her Bentley, a black woman with a driver and everything. She asked me where we lived, and when I told her, I just knew what was on her mind. How can somebody in Essex be thinking of the National Children's Orchestra? So I decided to look for trouble, and I told her, My daughter goes to Brentwood, and you should have seen her face. You know, people like us are not supposed to be talking about private school and music. The most we should want is a good grammar school. I just looked at the woman and I was laughing inside. Then she started telling me that music for children is very expensive. She kept telling me how expensive it is, as if she had seen my empty bank account. Imagine. She's one of those black people who want to be the only black person in the room, so any other black person is an immediate threat to her. She just called now to tell me that she read online about an 11-year-old girl who got grade 5 distinction and did not get into the National Children's Orchestra. How will she call just to tell me that negative story?
Enemy of progress, Bose said.
Is she a Jamaican? Amara asked. She's black British. I don't know where her people come from.
It must be Jamaica, Amara said.
Chapter 25. Sharp. The word everyone used to describe Emenike in secondary school. Sharp. Full of the poisoned admiration they felt for him. Sharp guy. Sharp man. If exam questions leaked, Emenike knew how to get to them. He knew too which girl had had an abortion, what property the parents of the wealthy students owned, which teachers were sleeping together. He always spoke quickly, pugnaciously, as though every conversation was an argument, the speed and force of his words suggesting authority and discouraging dissent. He knew, and he was full of an eagerness to know. Whenever Kayode returned from a London vacation, flush with relevance, Emenike would ask him about the latest music and films, and then examine his shoes and clothes.
Is this one designer? What is the name of this one?
Emenike would ask, his eyes feral with longing. He had told everyone that his father was the Igwe of his hometown, and had sent him to Lagos to live with an uncle until he turned 21, to avoid the pressures of princely life. But one day an old man arrived at school, wearing trousers with a mended patch near the knee, his face gaunt, his body bowed with the humiliation that poverty had forced on him. All the boys laughed after they discovered he was really Emenike's father. The laughter was soon forgotten, perhaps because nobody had ever fully believed the prince story. Kayode, after all, always called Emenike Bush Boy, behind his back. Or perhaps because they needed Emenike, who had information that nobody else did. This, the audacity of him, had drawn Obinze. Emenike was one of the few people for whom to read did not mean to study, and so they would spend hours talking about books, bartering knowledge for knowledge, and playing Scrabble. Their friendship grew. At university, when Emenike lived with him in the boys' quarters of his mother's house, people had sometimes mistaken him for a relative.
What of your brother? People would ask Obinze, and Obinze would say,
he's fine, without bothering to explain that he and Emenike were not related at all. But there were many things he did not know about Emenike, things he knew not to ask about. Emenike often left school for weeks, only vaguely saying that he had gone home, and he spoke endlessly of people who were making it abroad. His was the coiled, urgent restlessness of a person who believed that fate had mistakenly allotted him to a place below his true destiny. When he left for England during a strike in their second year, Obinze never knew how he got a visa. Still, he was pleased for him. Emenike was ripe, bursting with his ambition, and Obinze thought of his visa as a mercy. That ambition would finally find a release. It seemed to quite quickly, as Emenike sent news only of progress. His postgraduate work completed, his job at the housing authority, his marriage to an English woman who was a solicitor in the city. Emenike was the first person Obinze called after he arrived in England.
"The Zed! Good to hear from you. Let me call you back. I'm just going into a managerial meeting,"
Emenike said. The second time Obinze called, Emenike sounded a little hurried.
"I'm at Heathrow. Georgina and I are going to Brussels for a week. I'll call you when I get back. I can't wait to catch up, man."
Emenike's email response to Obinze had been similar.
"So happy you are coming this way, man. Can't wait to see you."
Obinze had imagined foolishly that Emenike would take him in, show him the way. He knew of the many stories of friends and relatives who, in the harsh glare of life abroad, became unreliable, even hostile versions of their former selves. But what was it about the stubbornness of hope, the need to believe in your own exceptionality, that these things happened to other people whose friends were not like yours? He called other friends. Nosa, who had left right after graduation, picked him up at the tube station and drove him to a pub where other friends soon gathered. They shook hands and slapped backs and drank draft beer. They laughed about memories from school. They said little about the details of their present lives.
When Obinze said he needed to get a national insurance number and asked, "Guys, how I go take do?" They all shook their heads vaguely.
"Ross, keep your ear to the ground, man,"
Chidi said. "The thing is, to come closer to central London, you're too far away from things in Essex," Wale said. As Nosa drove him back to the station later, Obinze asked, "So, where do you work, guy?"
"Underground, a serious hustle, but things will get better,"
Nosa said. Although Obinze knew he meant the tube, the word underground made him think of doomed tunnels that fed into the earth and went on forever, ending nowhere.
"What of Mr. Sharp Guy Emenike?"
Nosa asked, his tone alive with malice.
"He's doing very well, and he lives in Islington with his Oyinbo wife, who is old enough to be his mother. He has become poor shrew, who doesn't talk to ordinary people anymore. He can help sort you out."
"He's been traveling a lot. We haven't yet seen," Obinze said, hearing too clearly the limpness of his own words.
"How is your cousin, Iloba?"
Nosa asked.
"I saw him last year at Emeka's brother's wedding."
Obinze had not even remembered that Iloba now lived in London. He had last seen him days before graduation. Iloba was merely from his mother's hometown, but he had been so enthusiastic about their kinship that everyone on campus assumed they were cousins. Iloba would often pull up a chair, smiling and uninvited, and join Obinze and his friends at a roadside bar, or appear at Obinze's door on Sunday afternoons, when Obinze was tired from the languor of Sunday afternoons. Once, Iloba had stopped Obinze at the General Studies quad, cheerfully calling out, "Kinsman!" and then giving him a rundown of marriages and deaths of people from his mother's hometown whom he hardly knew.
"Udwapwani died some weeks ago. Don't you know him? Their homestead is next to your mother's."
Obinze nodded and made appropriate sounds, humouring Iloba, because Iloba's manner was always so pleasant and oblivious, his trousers always too tight and too short, showing his bony ankles. They had earned him the nickname Iloba Jump Up, which soon morphed to Loba J.U. Obinze got his phone number from Nicholas and called him.
"The Zed, kinsman, you did not tell me you were coming to London," Iloba said. "How is your mother? What of your uncle? The one who married from Abagana. How is Nicholas?"
Iloba sounded full of a simple happiness. There were people who were born with an inability to be tangled up in dark emotions, in complications, and Iloba was one of them. For such people, Obinze felt both admiration and boredom. When Obinze asked if Iloba might be able to help him find a national insurance number, he would have understood a little resentment, a little churlishness. After all, he was contacting Iloba only because he needed something. But it surprised him how sincerely eager to help Iloba was.
"I would let you use mine, but I'm working with it, and it is risky," Iloba said.
"Where do you work?"
"In central London. Security. It's not easy. This country is not easy, but we are managing. I like the night shifts because it gives me time to read for my course. I'm doing a master's in management at Birkbeck College."
Iloba paused.
"The Zed. Don't worry. We will put our heads together. Let me ask around and let you know."
Iloba called back 2 weeks later to say he had found somebody.
"His name is Vincent Ubi. He's from Abia State. A friend of mine did the connection. He wants to meet you tomorrow evening."
They met in Iloba's flat. A claustrophobic feel pervaded the flat. The concrete neighbourhood with no trees, the scarred walls of the building. Everything seemed too small, too tight.
"Nice place, Loba Jeyu,"
Obinze said, not because the flat was nice, but because Iloba had a flat in London.
"I would have told you to come and stay with me," he said, "but I live with two of my cousins."
Iloba placed bottles of beer and a small plate of fried chin-chin on the table. It seared a sharp homesickness in Obinze, this ritual of hospitality. He was reminded of going back to the village with his mother at Christmas, aunties offering him plates of chin-chin. Vincent Obi was a small, round man submerged in a large pair of jeans and an ungainly coat. As Obinze shook hands with him, they sized each other up. In the set of Vincent's shoulders, in the abrasiveness of his demeanour, Obinze sensed that Vincent had learned very early on, as a matter of necessity, to solve his own problems. Obinze imagined his Nigerian life, a community secondary school full of barefoot children, a polytechnic paid for with help from a number of uncles, a family of many children, and a crowd of dependents in his hometown, who, whenever he visited, would expect large loaves of bread and pocket money carefully distributed to each of them. Obinze saw himself through Vincent's eyes, a university staff child who grew up eating butter and now needed his help. At first Vincent affected a British accent, saying "in it" too many times.
"This is business, innit? But I am helping you. You can use my airline number and pay me 40% of what you make," Vincent said. "It's business, innit? If I don't get what we agree on, I will report you."
"My brother," Obinze said, "that's a little too much. You know my situation, I don't have anything. Please try and calm down."
35% is the best I can do. This is business."
He had lost his accent and now spoke Nigerian English.
"Let me tell you, there are many people in your situation."
Iloba spoke up in Igbo.
"Vincent, my brother here is trying to save money and do his papers. 35 is too much. Orika Biko, please just try and help us." "You know that some people take half. Yes, he's in a situation, but all of us are in a situation. I'm helping him, but this is business."
Vincent's Igbo had a rural accent. He put the national insurance card on the table and was already writing his bank account number on a piece of paper. Iloba's mobile began to ring. That evening, as dusk fell, the sky muting to a pale violet, Obinze became Vincent. Chapter 26. Obinze as Vincent informed his agency, after his experience with the cold shit on the toilet lid, that he would not be returning to that job. He scoured the newspaper job pages, made calls and hoped, until the agency offered him another job, cleaning wide passages in a detergent packing warehouse. A Brazilian man, sallow and dark-haired, cleaned the building next to his.
"I'm Vincent," Obinze said, when they met in the back room.
"I'm D."
A pause.
"No, you're not English, you can pronounce it. My real name is Duardinito, but the English, they cannot pronounce it, so they call me D."
"Duardinito," Obinze repeated.
"Yes!"
A delighted smile, a small bond of foreignness. They talked while emptying their vacuum cleaners about the 1996 Olympics, Obinze gloating about Nigeria beating Brazil, and then Argentina.
"Kano was good. I give him that," Duardinito said. "But Nigeria had luck."
Every evening, Obinze was covered in white chemical dust, gritty things lodged in his ears. He tried not to breathe too deeply as he cleaned, wary of dangers floating in the air, until his manager told him he was being fired because of a downsizing. The next job was a temporary replacement with a company that delivered kitchens, week after week of sitting beside white drivers who called him labourer, of endless construction sites full of noises and helmets, of carrying wooden planks up long stairs, unaided and unsung. In the silence with which they drove, and the tone with which they said labourer, Obinze sensed the driver's dislike. Once, when he tripped and landed on his knee, a fall so heavy that he limped back to the truck, the driver told the others at the warehouse,
"His knee is bad because he's a Negro."
They laughed. Their hostility rankled, but only slightly. What mattered to him was that he earned £4 an hour, more with overtime. And when he was sent to a new delivery warehouse in West Thurrock, he worried that he might not have opportunities for overtime. The new warehouse chief looked like the Englishman archetype Obinze carried in his mind, tall and spare, sandy-haired and blue-eyed. But he was a smiling man, and in Obinze's imagination, Englishmen were not smiling men. His name was Roy Snell. He vigorously shook Obinze's hand.
"So, Vincent, you're from Africa?"
he asked, as he took Obinze around the warehouse, the size of a football field, much bigger than the last one, and alive with trucks being loaded, flattened cardboard boxes being folded into a deep pit, men talking.
"Yes, I was born in Birmingham and went back to Nigeria when I was 6.
It was the story he and Iloba had agreed was most convincing.
"Why'd you come back?
How bad are things in Nigeria? I just wanted to see if I could have a better life here.
Roy Snell nodded. He seemed like a person for whom the word jolly would always be apt.
You'll work with Nigel today. He's our youngest, he said, gesturing towards a man with a pale, doughy body, spiky dark hair, and an almost cherubic face. I think you're going to like working here, Vinny boy.
It had taken him 5 minutes to go from Vincent to Vinny boy, and in the following months, when they played table tennis during lunch break, Roy would tell the men,
I've got to beat Vinny boy for once,
and they would titter and repeat,
Vinny boy.
It amused Obinze how keenly the men flipped through their newspapers every morning, stopping at the photo of the big-breasted woman, examining it as though it were an article of great interest, and were any different from the photo on that same page the previous day, the previous week. Their conversations, as they waited for their trucks to be loaded up, were always about cars and football, and most of all, women, each man telling stories that sounded too apocryphal and too similar to a story told the day before, the week before, and each time they mentioned knickers.
The bird flashed her knickers.
Obinze was even more amused, because knickers were in Nigerian English shorts rather than underwear, and he imagined these nubile women in ill-fitting khaki shorts, the kind he had worn as a junior student in secondary school. Roy Snell's morning greeting to him was a jab on his belly.
Vinny boy, you all right? You all right?
He would ask. He always put Obinze's name up for the outside work that paid better, always asked if he wanted to work weekends, which was double time, always asked about girls. It was as if Roy held a special affection for him, which was both protective and kind.
You haven't had a shag since you came to the UK, have you, Vinny boy? I could give you this bird's number,
he said once.
I have a girlfriend back home, Obinze said. So what's wrong with a little shag, then?
A few men nearby laughed.
My girlfriend has magical powers, Obinze said.
Roy found this funnier than Obinze thought it was. He laughed and laughed.
She's into witchcraft, is she? All right, then, no shags for you. I've always wanted to go to Africa, Vinny boy. I think I'll take a holiday and go to Nigeria when you're back there for a visit. You can show me around, find me some Nigerian birds, Vinny boy, but no witchcraft.
Yes, I could do that.
Oh, I know you could. You look like you know what to do with the birds,
Roy said, with another jab at Obinze's belly. Roy often assigned Obinze to work with Nigel, perhaps because they were the youngest men in the warehouse. That first morning, Obinze noticed that the other men, drinking coffee from paper cups and checking the board to see who would be working with whom, were laughing at Nigel. Nigel had no eyebrows. The patches of slightly pink skin where his eyebrows should have been gave his plump face an unfinished, ghostly look.
I got pissed at the pub, and my mate shaved off my eyebrows, Nigel told Obinze, almost apologetically, as they shook hands. No shagging for you until you grow your eyebrows back, mate, one of the men called out as Nigel and Obinze headed for the truck.
Obinze secured the washing machines at the back, tightening the straps until they were snug, and then climbed in and studied the map to find the shortest routes to their delivery addresses. Nigel took Ben sharply and muttered about how people drove these days. At a traffic light, Nigel brought out a bottle of cologne from the bag he placed at his feet, sprayed it on his neck, and then offered it to Obinze.
No thanks, Obinze said.
Nigel shrugged. Days later he offered it again. The truck interior was dense with the scent of his cologne, and Obinze would from time to time take deep gulps of fresh air through the open window.
You're just new from Africa. You haven't seen the London sights, have you, mate?
Nigel asked.
No, Obinze said.
And so, after early deliveries in central London, Nigel would take him for a drive, showing him Buckingham Palace, the Houses of Parliament, Tower Bridge, all the while talking about his mother's arthritis and about his girlfriend Haley's knockers. It took a while to completely understand what Nigel said, because of his accent, which was only a deeper version of the accents of the people Obinze had worked with, each word twisted and stretched until it came out of their mouths having become something else. Once Nigel said, mail, and Obinze thought he had said, mile, and when Obinze finally understood what Nigel meant, Nigel laughed and said, you talk kind of posh, didn't you? African posh. One day, months into his job,
After they delivered a new fridge to an address in Kensington, Nigel said about the elderly man who had come into the kitchen, "He's a real gent, he is." Nigel's tone was admiring, slightly cowed. The man had looked dishevelled and hung over, his hair tousled, his robe open at the chest, and he had said archly, "You do know how to put it all together," as though he did not think they did. It amazed Obinze that because Nigel thought the man was a real gent, he did not complain about the dirty kitchen, as he ordinarily would have done. And if the man had spoken with a different accent, Nigel would have called him miserly for not giving them a tip. They were approaching their next delivery address in South London, and Obinze had just called the homeowner to say that they were almost there, when Nigel blurted out, "What do you say to a girl you like?" "What do you mean?" Obinze asked. "Truth is, I'm not really shagging Ailey. I like her, but I don't know how to tell her. The other day I went round her house and there was another bloke there." Nigel paused. Obinze tried to keep his face expressionless. "You look like you know what to say to birds, mate," Nigel added. "Just tell her you like her," Obinze said, thinking how seamlessly Nigel at the warehouse with other men often contributed stories of his shagging Haley, and once of shagging her friend while Haley was away on holiday. "No games, and no lines. Just say, 'Look, I like you, and I think you're beautiful.'" Nigel gave him a wounded glance. It was as if he had convinced himself that Obinze was skilled in the art of women, and expected some profundity, which Obinze wished as he loaded the dishwasher onto a trolley and wheeled it to the door, that he had. An Indian woman opened the door, a portly, kindly housewife, who offered them tea. Many people offered tea or water. Once a sad-looking woman had offered Obinze a small pot of homemade jam, and he had hesitated, but he sensed that whatever deep unhappiness she had would be compounded if he said no, and so he had taken the jam home, and it was still languishing in the fridge, unopened. "Thank you, thank you," the Indian woman said as Obinze and Nigel installed the new dishwasher and rolled away the old. At the door, she gave Nigel a tip. Nigel was the only driver who split the tips down the middle with Obinze. The others pretended not to remember to share. Once, when Obinze was working with another driver, an old Jamaican woman had pushed £10 into his pocket when the driver was not looking. "Thank you, brother," she said, and it made him want to call his mother in Nsoka and tell her about it. Chapter 27 A glum dusk was settling over London when Obinze walked into the bookshop cafe and sat down to a mocha and blueberry scone. The soles of his feet ached pleasantly. It was not very cold. He had been sweating in Nicholas's wool coat, which now hung on the back of his chair. This was his weekly treat, to visit the bookshop, buy an overpriced caffeinated drink, read as much as he could for free, and become Obinze again. Sometimes he asked to be dropped off in central London after a delivery, and he would wander about and end up in a bookshop and sink to the floor at a corner, away from the clusters of people. He read contemporary American fiction, because he hoped to find a resonance, a shaping of his longings, a sense of the America that he had imagined himself a part of. He wanted to know about day-to-day life in America, what people ate and what consumed them, what shamed them and what attracted them. But he read novel after novel and was disappointed. Nothing was grave, nothing serious, nothing urgent, and most dissolved into ironic nothingness. He read American newspapers and magazines, but only skimmed the British newspapers, because there were more and more articles about immigration, and each one stoked new panic in his chest. Schools swamped by asylum seekers. He still hadn't found someone. Last week, he had met two Nigerian men, distant friends of a friend, who said they knew an Eastern European woman, and he had paid them £100. Now they did not return his calls, and their mobile phones went directly to voicemail. His scone was half-eaten. He did not realize how quickly the cafe had filled up. He was comfortable, cozy even, and absorbed in a magazine article, when a woman and a little boy came up to ask if they could share his table. They were nut-colored and dark-haired. He imagined that they were Bangladeshi or Sri Lankan. "Of course," he said, and shifted his pile of books and magazines, even though it had not been on the side of the table that they would use. The boy looked 8 or 9 years old, wearing a Mickey Mouse sweater and clutching a blue Game Boy. The woman was wearing a nose ring, a tiny glass-like thing that glittered as she moved her head this way and that. She asked if he had enough room for his magazines, if he wanted her to move her chair a little. Then she told her son, in a laughing tone that was clearly intended for Obinze, that she had never been very sure if those narrow wooden sticks next to the packets of sugar were for stirring.
"I'm not a baby,"
her son said when she wanted to cut his muffin. "I just thought it would be easier for you." Obinze looked up and saw that she was talking to her son, but she was watching him, with something wistful in her eyes. It filled him with possibility, this chance meeting with a stranger, and the thought of the paths on which it might lead him. The little boy had a delightful, curious face.
"Do you live in London?"
he asked Obinze. "Yes," Obinze said, but that yes did not tell his story, that he lived in London indeed, but invisibly, his existence like an erased pencil sketch. Each time he saw a policeman, or anyone in the uniform, anyone with the faintest scent of authority, he would fight the urge to run.
"His father passed away last year," the woman said in a lower voice. "This is our first vacation in London without him. We used to do it every year before Christmas."
The woman nodded continuously as she spoke, and the boy looked annoyed, as if he had not wanted Obinze to know that.
"I'm sorry," Obinze said.
"We went to the Tate," the boy said.
"Did you like it?" Obinze asked.
He scowled.
"It was boring."
His mother stood up. "We should go. We're going to see a play."
She turned to her son and added,
"You are not taking that Game Boy in. You know that."
The boy ignored her, said, "Bye," to Obinze, and turned towards the door. The mother gave Obinze a long look, even more wistful than before. Perhaps she had deeply loved her husband, and this, her first awareness of feeling attraction again, was a startling revelation. He watched them leave, wondering whether to get up and ask for her contact information, and yet knowing he would not. There was something about the woman that made him think of love, and as always, Ifemelu came to his mind when he thought of love. Then quite suddenly, a sexual urge overcame him, a tide of lust. He wanted to fuck somebody. He would text Tendai. They had met at a party Nosa took him to, and he ended up that night in her bed. Wise and large-hipped, and Zimbabwean Tendai, who had a habit of soaking in baths for too long. She stared at him in shock the first time he cleaned her flat and cooked jollof rice for her. She was so unused to being treated well by a man that she watched him endlessly, anxiously, her eyes veiled, as though holding her breath and waiting for the abuse to emerge. She knew he didn't have his papers.
"Or you would be the kind of Nigerian working in IT in driving a BMW, she said.
She had a British stay and would have a passport in a year, and she hinted that she might be willing to help him. But he did not want the complication of marrying her for his papers. One day she would wake up and convince herself that it had never been merely for papers. Before he left the bookshop, he sent Tendai a text.
"Are you home? Was thinking of stopping by."
A freezing drizzle was falling as he walked to the tube station, tiny raindrops splattering his coat, and when he got there, he was absorbed by how many blobs of saliva were on the stairs. Why did people not wait until they left the station to spit? He sat on the stained seat of the noisy train, opposite a woman reading the evening paper. "Speak English at home," Blunkett tells immigrants. He imagined the article she was reading. There were so many of them now published in the newspapers, and they echoed the radio and television, even the chatter of some of the men in the warehouse. The wind blowing across the British Isles was odorous with fear of asylum seekers, infecting everybody with a panic of impending doom, and so articles were written and read, simply and stridently, as though the writers lived in a world in which the present was unconnected to the past, and they had never considered this to be the normal course of history, the influx into Britain of black and brown people from countries created by Britain. Yet he understood. It had to be comforting, this denial of history. The woman closed the newspaper and looked at him. She had stringy brown hair and hard, suspicious eyes. He wondered what she was thinking, Was she wondering whether he was one of those illegal immigrants who were overcrowding an already crowded island? Later, on the train to Essex, he noticed that all the people around him were Nigerians. Loud conversations in Yoruba and Pidgin filled the carriage, and for a moment he saw the unfettered non-white foreignness of this scene through the suspicious eyes of the white woman on the tube. He thought again of the Sri Lankan or Bangladeshi woman, and the shadow of grief from which he was only just emerging, and he thought of his mother, and of Ifemelu, and the life he had imagined for himself, and the life he now had, lacquered as it was by work and reading, by panic and hope. He had never felt so lonely. Chapter 28. One morning in early summer, a renewing warmth in the air, Obinze arrived at the warehouse and knew right away that something was amiss. The men avoided his eyes, an unnatural stiffness in their movements, and Nigel turned swiftly, too swiftly, towards the toilet when he saw Obinze. They knew. It had to be that they had somehow found out. They saw the headlines about asylum seekers draining the National Health Service. They knew of the hordes further crowding a crowded island. And now they knew that he was one of the damned, working with a name that was not his. Where was Roy Snell? Had he gone to call the police? Was it the police that one called? Obinze tried to remember details from the stories of people who had been caught and deported, but his mind was numb. He felt naked. He wanted to turn and run, but his body kept moving, against his will, towards the loading area. Then he sensed a movement behind him, quick and violent and too close, and before he could turn around, a paper hat had been pushed onto his head. It was Nigel, and with him a gathering of grinning men. "Happy birthday, Vinny boy," they all said. Obinze froze, frightened by the complete blankness of his mind. Then he realized what it was. Vincent's birthday. Roy must have told the men. Even he had not remembered to remember Vincent's date of birth. "Oh," was all he said, nauseous from relief. Nigel asked him to come into the coffee room, where all the men were trooping in, and as Obinze sat with them, all of them white, except for Patrick from Jamaica, passing around the muffins and coke they had bought with their own money in honor of a birthday they believed was his, a realization brought tears to his eyes. He felt safe. Vincent called him that evening, and Obinze was mildly surprised, because Vincent had called him only once, months ago, when he changed his bank and wanted to give him the new account number. He wondered whether to say happy birthday to Vincent, whether indeed the call was somehow related to the occasion of the birthday. "Vincent, Kedu," he said.
"I want a raise."
Had Vincent learned that from a film? Those words, "I want a raise," sounded contrived and comical.
"I want 45%. I know you are working more now."
"Vincent, how much am I making? You know I am saving money to do this marriage thing."
45%,
Vincent said, and hung up. Obinze decided to ignore him. He knew Vincent's type. They would push to see how far they could go, and then they would step back. If he called back and tried to negotiate, it might embolden Vincent to make more demands. That he walked in every week to Vincent's bank to deposit money into his account was something Vincent would not risk losing entirely. And so, when a week later, in the morning bustle of drivers and trucks, Roy said,
"Vinny boy, step into my office for a minute."
Obinze thought nothing of it. On Roy's desk was a newspaper, folded at the page with a photo of the big-breasted woman. Roy slowly put his cup of coffee on top of the newspaper. He seemed uncomfortable, not looking directly at Obinze.
"Somebody called yesterday. Said you're not who you say you are, that you're illegal and working with a Brit's name."
There was a pause. Obinze was stung with surprise. Roy picked up the coffee cup again.
"Why didn't you just bring in your passport tomorrow and we'll clear it up, all right?"
Obinze mumbled the first words that came to him.
"Okay, I'll bring my passport tomorrow."
He walked out of the office, knowing that he would never remember what he had felt moments ago. Was Roy merely asking him to bring his passport to make the dismissal easier for him, to give him an exit? Or did Roy really believe that the caller had been wrong? Why would anybody call about such a thing, unless it was true? Obinze had never made as much of an effort as he did the rest of the day to seem normal, to tame the rage that was engulfing him. It was not the thought of the power that Vincent had over him that infuriated him, but the recklessness with which Vincent had exercised it. He left the warehouse that evening, for the final time, wishing more than anything that he had told Nigel and Roy his real name. Some years later, in Lagos, after Chief told him to find a white man whom he could present as his general manager, Obinze called Nigel. His mobile number had not changed.
"This is Vinnie Boy."
"Vincent, are you all right, mate?"
"I'm fine. How are you?"
Obinze said.
Then later he said, "Vincent is not my real name, Nigel. My name is Obinze. I have a job offer for you in Nigeria."
Chapter 29. The Angolans told him how things had gone up, or were more tough. Opaque words that were supposed to explain each new request for more money.
"This is not what we agreed to," Obinze would say, or, "I don't have any extra cash right now." And they would reply, "Things have gone up, yeah,"
in a tone that he imagined was accompanied by a shrug. A silence would follow, a wordlessness over the phone line that told him that it was his problem, not theirs.
"I'll pay it in by Friday," he would say finally, before hanging up.
Cleotilde's gentle sympathy assuaged him. She told him, "They've got my passport," and he thought this vaguely sinister, almost a hostage holding.
"Otherwise we could just do this on our own," she added, but he did not want to do it on his own, with Cleotilde. It was too important, and he needed the weight of the Angolans' expertise, their experience, to make sure all went well.
Nicholas had already lent him some money. He had been loath enough to ask at all because of the judgment in Nicholas's unsmiling eyes, as though he was thinking that Obinze was soft, spoilt, and many people did not have a cousin who could lend them money. Emenike was the only other person he could ask. The last time they spoke, Emenike had told him,
"I don't know if you've seen this play in the West End, but Georgina and I have just been, and we loved it."
As though Obinze, in his delivery job, saving austerely, consumed by immigration worries, would ever even think of seeing a West End play. Emenike's obliviousness had upset him, because it suggested a disregard, and even worse, an indifference to him and to his present life. He called Emenike and said, speaking quickly, pushing the words out, that he needed £500, which he would pay back as soon as he could find another job, and then, more slowly, he told Emenike about the Angolans and how close he was to finally doing the marriage ceremony, but there were so many extra costs that he had not budgeted for.
"No problem. Let's meet Friday," Emenike said.
Now Emenike sat across from Obinze in a dimly lit restaurant, after shrugging off his jacket to reveal a tan cashmere sweater that looked faultless. He had not put on weight like most of his other friends now living abroad. Didn't look different from the last time Obinze had seen him in Nsoka.
"Man, the Zed, you look well," he said, his words aflame with dishonesty.
Of course Obinze did not look well, shoulders hunched from stress, in clothes borrowed from his cousin.
"I beg sorry I haven't had time to see you. My work schedule is crazy, and we've also been traveling a lot. I would have asked you to come and stay with us, but it's not a decision I can take alone. Georgina won't understand. You know these Oyimbo people don't behave like us."
His lips moved, forming something that looked like a smirk. He was making fun of his wife, but Obinze knew from the muted awe in his tone that it was mockery coloured by respect, mockery of what he believed, despite himself, to be inherently superior. Obinze remembered how Kayode had often said about Emenike in secondary school,
"He can read all the books he wants, but the bush is still in his blood." "We've just come back from America. Man, you need to go to America. No other country like it in the world. We flew to Denver and then drove to Wyoming. Georgina had just finished a really tough case. You remember I told you when I was going to Hong Kong? She was there for work and I flew over for a long weekend. So I thought we should go to America. She needed the holiday.
Emenike's phone beeped. He took it out of his pocket, glanced at it, and grimaced, as though he wanted to be asked what the text was about, but Obinze did not ask. He was tired. Iloba had given him his own national insurance card, even though it was risky for both of them to work at the same time, but all the job agencies Obinze had tried so far wanted to see a passport and not just the card. His beer tasted flat, and he wished Emenike would just give him the money. But Emenike resumed talking, gesturing, his movements fluid and sure, his manner still that of a person convinced they knew things that other people would never know. And yet there was something different in him that Obinze could not name. Emenike talked for a long time, often prefacing a story with, "The thing you have to understand about this country is this." Obinze's mind strayed to Cleotilde. The Angolan said at least two people from her side had to come to Newcastle to avoid any suspicion, but she had called him yesterday to suggest that she bring only one friend, so he would not have to pay for the train and hotel bills of two extra people. He had found it sweet, but he asked her to bring the two anyway. He would take no chances. Emenike was talking about something that had happened at work.
"I had actually arrived at the meeting first, kept my files, and then I went to the loo, only to come back and for this stupid Onyimbo man to tell me, 'Oh, I see you are keeping to African time.' And you know what? I just told him off. Since then he has been sending me emails to go for a drink." "Drink for what?"
Emenike sipped his beer. It was his third, and he had become looser and louder. All his stories about work had the same arc. Somebody would first underestimate or belittle him, and he would then end up victorious with a final clever word or action.
"Ah, Miss Niger, it's been so long, but I just haven't had the time to travel back home. Besides, Georgina would not survive a visit to Nigeria,"
Emenike said, and laughed. He had cast home as the jungle, and himself as interpreter of the jungle.
"Another beer?" Emenike asked.
Obinze shook his head. A man trying to get to the table behind them brushed Emenike's jacket down from behind his chair.
"Ah, look at this man. He wants to ruin my aqua scutum. It was my last birthday present from Georgina,"
Emenike said, hanging the jacket back behind his chair. Obinze did not know the brand, but he knew from the stylish smirk on Emenike's face that he was supposed to be impressed.
"Sure you don't want another beer?"
Emenike asked, looking around for the waitress.
"She's ignoring me. Did you notice how rude she was earlier? These Eastern Europeans just don't like serving black people."
After the waitress had taken his order, Emenike brought out an envelope from his pocket.
"Here it is, man. I know you asked for 500, but it's 1,000. You want to count it?"
"Count it?" Obinze nearly said, but the words did not leave his mouth. To be given money in the Nigerian manner was to have it pushed into your hands, fists closed, eyes averted from yours, your effusive thanks, and it had to be effusive, waved away. And you certainly did not count the money, sometimes did not even look at it until you were alone. But here was Emenike asking him to count the money. And so he did, slowly, deliberately, moving each note from one hand to the other, wondering if Emenike had hated him all those years in secondary school and university. He had not laughed at Emenike as Kayode and the other boys did, but he had not defended Emenike either. Perhaps Emenike had despised his neutrality. "Thanks, man," Obinze said. Of course it was £1,000. Did Emenike think a £50 note might have slipped out on his way to the restaurant?
"It's not a loan,"
Emenike said, leaning back on his seat, smiling thinly. "Thanks, man," Obinze said again, and despite it all he was grateful and relieved. It had worried him how many things he still had to pay for before the wedding, and if this was what it took, counting a cash gift while Emenike watched with power in his gaze, then so be it. Emenike's phone rang.
"Georgina,"
he said happily, before he took the call. His voice was slightly raised for Obinze's benefit.
"It's fantastic to see him again after so long."
Then after a pause,
"Of course, darling, we should do that."
He put his phone down and told Obinze,
Georgina wants to come and meet us in the next half hour so we can all go to dinner. Is that okay?
Obinze shrugged.
I never say no to food.
Just before Georgina arrived, Emenike told him